the dressing down of Miami's police chief, security concerns continue in Broward schools, and the new effort to protect immigrant dreamers. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The Miami police chief is under political fire for referring to the Cuban exile community as the Cuban Mafia. He apologized, but it has led to two public hearings with the city's Cuban American commissioners going after the city's Cuban American top cop. The State Safety Commission, created after the Parkland shooting, says Broward schools still need to do more to protect students. And the Biden administration wants to do more to protect DACA immigrants. A new proposal would bring back the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What could it mean here in South Florida? It's all ahead on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Please continue to make your contributions during our program. An only in South Florida drama has been unfolding this week in the City of Miami Commission chambers. It has all the makings of a modern-day telenovela. Outlandish statements, character assassination, plenty of flashback scenes. The main characters of this drama are the city's police chief, Art Acevedo, and a handful of the City of Miami commissioners. The commission held a special meeting earlier this week where they spent several hours digging into the chief's past. Here's Commissioner Alex De La Portilla speaking about the police chief.
We all know what the problem is. He's just, you know, he's a square peg in a round hole in Miami.
Part two is about to start as we're live here on WLRN this Friday afternoon. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero is with us at Miami City Hall waiting for this second act to begin. Danny, what led to these commission hearings for these special meetings regarding the City of Miami Police Chief Acevedo, who's been here for about 6 months or so?
How much time we got, Tom? No, this has been a rapidly unfolding major drama that's playing out, and it started with the way that the city manager and the mayor brought the chief of police on board. Basically, there was an interviewing process that was happening at the City of Miami Police Department, and Mayor Suarez kind of went around that process and recruited the chief of police of Houston to come on directly, and the city manager hired him. It came as a surprise to a lot of people in City Hall, so there was a lot of anger about that the process wasn't transparent enough, they said. And then it really rapidly escalated because the chief of police was implementing many reforms he said was needed at the police department, and he was facing pushback from some members from inside the police department. And when he was addressing that at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, he made a comment that it's almost like the Cuban Mafia runs the City of Miami Police Department, which then angered some commissioners even more, and that led up to the meeting. And there's a lot of other things, but it's been very rapidly escalating. That's the general story.
Yeah, so set the stage for this second hearing. The earlier hearing this week, several hours long, it included videos of the police chief from many years ago dancing in an Elvis costume that was too tight, a couple of sizes too small, as one of the Miami commissioners pointed out. Not sure exactly what that has to do with law enforcement necessarily, but I guess it was calling into question the character of Chief Acevedo.
Right. I mean, what we saw at the special meeting that was held on Monday, very little of what was discussed had to do with what's going on right now at the police department. A lot of it was really attacking the character and the integrity on a personal level of the police chief. They were pulling up any article they could find with, allegedly controversial things that all going all the way back to the 1980s when he was with the California Highway Patrol. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that they brought up were later tossed out in court. They were unsubstantiated. Some of them were true. But it did, you know, a lot of what the pressure that was coming on to the city manager, because the city manager is the only one that can fire the police chief. So right. They were really pressing the city manager about all these things in the chief of police's past and saying, were you aware of this? Were you aware of this? Were you aware of that? And the city manager actually just said, no, we were not. We did not conduct a full background check into the police chief.
So a couple of things to ask about here and talk about, Danny. One is the City of Miami Police Department only recently came out from under the microscope of the federal government and its behavior. Right. And the chief here was really seen as a change agent for this department. How is that influencing potentially this investigation on the part of the city commission?
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And the Department of Justice just lifted its oversight earlier this year, but it was broadly acknowledged that more changes in the culture of the police department and the structuring of it had to be made. And so the chief of police came in as a self-described reformer. He really shook things up. He made a couple of firings that some people in the police department were not happy with. He demoted a handful of people. He promoted another handful of people and just really shook up the leadership. And that does not sit well with a lot of people that have been in the police department for a very long time. Yeah. He's a new face. He's not necessarily in any clique, I would say. He doesn't have the same level of loyalty as longtime officers who have been on the force for a decade, two decades together. He's coming in as an outsider and shaking things up, which is exactly what the city manager said needed to be done. They needed to shake up the department.
There's also the undeniable element here, Danny, of race.
Right. The main police union that is the negotiating union, they did an internal poll and they say that the majority of officers want the chief of police out. The counterpoint to that is that the Black police union is strongly supporting the chief of police. They're saying, listen, you know, he made a comment about the Cuban mafia. We don't necessarily agree with that. He apologized for that. Take that aside. They're saying this chief of police is doing exactly what has to be done. He's shaking up the department in ways that need to be shaken up. And they say he's brought diversity to it, not just for African-Americans, but they're also citing he brought in white women into higher positions. He brought in white men into higher positions. And he's kind of, by doing that, he has shaken up the leadership of the department itself, which has historically, over the last several decades, been predominantly run by Cuban Americans. So he's really taken actions that are shaking up the power structure of the city, because it was almost taken as a given that Cuban Americans would be calling all the shots. And the irony, of course, is that Chief Acevedo is Cuban American.
Right.
He's just not Miami Cuban American.
Right.
He was born on the island and raised in Los Angeles, so he's coming from a different place.
Yeah, he immigrated through Miami from the island and then grew up on the west coast of the United States. Danny
exactly.
Rivera, we'll let you get back to the commission chambers as that hearing is about to start. Danny Rivera reporting here during the South Florida Roundup from the Miami City Commission chambers as the second hearing this week into the police chief Art Acevedo is about to begin. Still to come on our program here, special pledge program, continue making those donations. Coming up, the Public Safety Commission tasked with identifying opportunities to prevent mass violent events from occurring in Florida schools has found the Broward School District needs to step up its efforts. That's next as the South Florida Roundup continues. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. Remember, continue to make those contributions on the telephone, by text, or by the website during our program today. A public safety commission that was formed after the 2018 Marjory Stoneman Douglas school shooting has found that the Broward Public School District still has a lot of work to do to prevent another mass violence event. The Marjory Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission expressed concerns to Interim Superintendent Vicki Cartwright this week about the time it takes for the district to implement safety-related changes. Here's the commission's chair, Bob Gualtieri.
And this is the lack of urgency. This shows a culture problem, and I hope that you're going to change that culture.
The commission was created to analyze information about mass violence in the state and to make recommendations that would prevent further incidents. Share your thoughts about school safety in South Florida on Twitter with us at WLRN is our handle. Scott Travis covers education for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. He joins us now. Scott, welcome back to the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
How would you describe the commission's concerns 3 years after this tragedy?
Well, I think the school district has been the commission believes that they lacked urgency when it comes to a lot of these matters, and that they Broward was ground zero for the tragedy. Mm-hmm. And they should be the ones that are leading the state. Now, one of the things there's an issue here is that there's a difference of philosophy, because Broward has focused more on gun control and a lot of other issues that are not of concern to the MSD commission. So they spent a lot of time doing the March for Our Lives stuff in the beginning. And the commission felt like they really needed to spend more time doing things related to school hardening and making sure that you can prevent intruders from getting onto campus.
Yeah, well, regarding the school hardening, I mean, this was part of the legislative response immediately after the Parkland tragedy. The Florida legislature approved, you know, the first firearms regulations for the first time in many, many years, and also provided for hundreds of millions of dollars in school hardening for schools across the district. I also want to ask you about some of the many measures that the commission has recommended and pushed for regarding school safety and response. But regarding school hardening, what is it that the commission feels that the Broward schools are maybe coming up short?
Well, I think that they felt like they were, I don't know that they listed any specific issues that they had with school hardening per se, mm-hmm. except they felt like that they did them way too slow, mm-hmm. that there wasn't an active assailant policy for the school district until a year after the shooting. And they felt that should have been something they did right away, that there should have been police officers, that they were not really quick in trying to get the one police officer or one armed guardian on every single campus, that they ended up doing that and meeting the deadline, but they really scrambled to do that at the last minute back in 2018. So they just feel like that they're not really moving fast enough.
Yeah. Is there a measuring stick for the speed at which school districts in Florida have been responding to some of these new regulations and some of the ambitions that the safety commission has put forward?
Yeah, they haven't really set a timeline for when anything's supposed to be done, unless it's determined by state law. And right. On those cases that they have, I mean, for the most part, Broward has met those issues. But the commissioner or the chair asked them about a plan for reunification, for making sure that families mm-hmm. can get together in the event of a tragedy, so that they can let everyone know what's going on. And the chair asked the Broward School District, can you send us your plan? And he assumed that they already had one done, and the school district developed one after they got that call and just approved it a couple of weeks ago.
Hmm. Yeah. So when this safety commission chair, Sheriff Gualtieri from the Gulf Coast, says there's a lack of urgency, he called it this week a culture problem. You've covered this from that awful, awful day at Marjory Stoneman. What is in your estimation the chairman referring to in terms of a culture problem at Broward schools?
I think that especially when the former superintendent Robert Runcie was there, they felt like he would promise to do all these things and nothing would actually get done, or it'd be done grudgingly, whether it was making sure that the people who were the administrators were investigated. He took a long time to start an investigation on there, whether it came time to doing what they called hard corners or safe spaces, where they have spots where they can actually have kids can hide out in the event of a tragedy. They waited until a year or so after that. And I've heard them say multiple times that this is where the tragedy happened. You all should be a leader on that. And basically, they felt like they're not taking the initiative themselves, that basically they are doing what the commission is requiring, but they're doing it grudgingly after being pressured.
So there have been changes, new people elected to the school board since that awful day at Marjorie Stoneman. And there's a new interim superintendent, Vicki Cartwright. Former superintendent Robert Runcie stepped down. The interim superintendent began just in August. So what recommendations has she walked into? What has her influence been in terms of the response from the district to this criticism from the safety commission?
Well, she has shown a willingness to try to do exactly what they want, which they like. So like there's an issue with their PROMISE program where it's a alternative to arrest program, and that the district was not sharing data with other law enforcement agencies. And they have put that, that she decided that she would start sharing data. The previous superintendent and general counsel basically were trying to use excuses to say why they did not need to share that information, that it wasn't really a diversion program, that it was an alternative to suspension program. And she realized that the state wasn't going to tolerate this anymore. So she went on and changed that and started sharing data. She also, there's an issue with Sheriff Tony where he had wanted some geocoding for cameras so that you could tell precisely where on a school campus an incident was happening. And they had not done that previously. And once she got there, she made sure that that was being done. So basically she was saying, as soon as she's learning about these things, she's taking care of them. But this commission also feels like that they would get that same thing from Runcie, that after he would get pressure from the commission, then they would take action. But there was never any kind of proactive things they were doing.
So what's the response from parents been like here, Scott? Particularly as, you know, as this criticism was voiced publicly this week, the first time the commission met in person since the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that there are probably two schools of thoughts. There are some people who feel like that the commission is being unfair to the school district, that they are really trying to turn the schools into a police state, and that they really want to have all these people with guns on campus, and they really aren't focusing on the right things, and they would prefer that the school district focused on keeping guns out of the hands of people and kids through gun control measures. And then there's other people who feel like that the school district has just not stepped up to the plate when it comes to school safety, and that they feel like that there another tragedy could happen and it could be preventable because the school district isn't taking this as seriously as they should.
So as the safety commission here has continued its comments, its public comments and criticisms, there's also been a state grand jury that's been investigating what began is, of course, that tragedy at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and then kind of expanded a little bit in terms of school safety. How do these two things kind of go together going forward? Kind of help us sort through, you know, the public commission and its criticisms and what potentially could come out of the grand jury.
Well, the grand jury has had a much broader focus because they have actually been looking at a lot of issues that don't have anything to do with safety per se, because they've been looking at the school district's use of the $800 million bond referendum, mm-hmm. and how they have had some questionable technology contracts that have come through that too. And that's ended up in the arrest of Tony Hunter, who was a former chief information officer, as well as Robert Runcie and former general counsel Barbara Myrick for allegedly lying or improperly sharing information related to that. So, but the grand jury has also been looking at some safety issues too, like mental health, and also whether schools have been good about having armed safe school officers. And they found a lot of, they felt like there's a lot of non-compliance statewide, but really the grand jury's kind of school safety recommendations haven't been all that much focused on Broward per se,
right,
but you know, the state as a whole.
Yeah, it's a broader scope there. For that state impaneled grand jury, what are you going to be watching?
And also, we still have not gotten the report yet.
We've
been waiting on that for months. But
yeah. Important point. We've seen some actions being taken out of the grand jury, as you mentioned, some of the arrests that have happened and charges filed, but we still have not yet seen the full grand jury report. What are you going to be watching in terms of safety measures in the coming months as this safety commission continues and leads up to the legislative session, and what may, you know, what could turn into a legislative proposal for lawmakers to consider?
Yeah, I think we're going to be looking at, I think we're, it also depends on what's going to be in the grand jury report, which supposedly could come out within the next few weeks or months, depending on how long they take. But I think they'll be looking at some changes to mental health to try to make it where there's better communication, and that when a student has needs help, that there's better communication between mental health professionals, educators, law enforcement, so that they can kind of do a more holistic approach to try to help those kids. There's been kind of a everyone's kind of worked in silos in the past. So I think there's going to be maybe a mental health commission is one of the recommendations of the grand jury that may come out of that. There's also a policy or a law that says that if you put a threat to shoot up a school in writing, then that's a crime. But if you just call someone up and say you're going to do it, then that's not a crime. The MSD Commission has recommended that they change that. And they say that some members of the legislature have actually been resistant to do that because they're worried about punishing trash talk or things when people aren't really serious. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. Scott, thanks so much for sharing all the reporting with us here on the South Florida Rondo. Much appreciated.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Scott Travis covers education for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Still to come on our program, the White House hopes to bring back DACA, the immigration strategy protecting people who came to the United States as children. That's next on this special Pledge Edition. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. A special Pledge Edition. Continue to make those contributions to WLRN during our programming, and thank you for your continued support for public radio. This week, the Biden administration took steps to bring back DACA, the Obama-era immigration policy officially called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The policy paused taking immigration action against people who entered the United States illegally when they were children. The rule was suspended by President Trump, and a federal judge found the original DACA rule was unconstitutional. About 1 million people were then left in limbo, including tens of thousands of people here in Florida. Tim Padgett is the America's editor here at WLRN. Tim, how is the Biden administration hoping to change or will be changing DACA?
Well, what they really want to do is protect it from the kind of litigation that we saw, frankly, earn a big victory in July in Texas.
Right.
A federal judge there in Texas over the summer essentially said that the Obama administration back in 2012 had violated certain tenets of the Administrative Procedures Act when it enacted the DACA program, and therefore it was going to put it on hold, as you pointed out, not really getting rid of it, but not allowing any more new applicants for DACA. And this was a big victory because, as you'll recall, a year ago, the Supreme Court had weighed in on this and had ruled against the Trump administration, right, which was trying to get rid of DACA altogether. And ironically, its reasoning was, you didn't follow the administrative procedures, you know,
right,
correctly. So,
right,
so it, this is all, almost sort of a tit for tat. But this, the Biden administration now is trying to strengthen how DACA is constructed so that it's not vulnerable to that kind of judicial ruling anymore.
Alina Santana is also with us, immigration attorney with Santana Rodriguez Law in Miami. Alina, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
So as the Biden administration puts forward this new rule for the DHS, what could be the impact on Dreamers here in South Florida?
So, you know, it'll take a little while, as was being explained. It's going to go through a rulemaking process that includes a 60-day comment period. And it's going to recreate the program that's already in place. So this isn't anything that's going to change who qualifies or doesn't qualify. It's just going to strengthen it so that it can stand up to litigation. What it will change, I mean, on a sanity level, I know there's a lot of people being affected who are happy to see this program be more protected, but it's not going to change who qualifies long term. For that, we truly need some meaningful legislation to be passed to get a pathway to citizenship.
Right. There's a window of eligibility that was in the original rule that President Obama put forth back in 2012. And Tim, this Biden administration kind of...
No, it doesn't change those parameters at all, really, as far as we can say. And that's disappointing a lot of immigration advocates who want to see, for example, to qualify for DACA now, you have to have come in to the country in 2007 or before. You had to be present here in the country in 2012 when DACA was enacted. Mm-hmm. And you had to be here in the country, you had to have been born before 1981. Immigration advocates are saying, look, that's really outdated parameters now. We've got to expand, mm-hmm. you know, who's eligible. I don't think the DHS procedures that they're putting into place or the rules that they're putting into place now do that. And as I said, that's disappointing a lot of immigration advocates.
And Alina, will it, in your estimation, do you think it's going to invite more potential DACA recipients to apply for the program, this application, which has been on hold?
I hope that it will. You know, I think we all hope that it will. There are a few new wrinkles. The wrinkles include, you know, the filing fees being modified, a specific category being set up for employment authorization for DACA participants. And the rule also clarifies that DACA beneficiaries are lawfully present for purposes of Social Security. But these aren't the big meaningful changes that we really want to see. We are hopeful that more people will come forward and apply. But as I mentioned, we really need that congressional change.
What has been the status of Dreamers over the past 9 months, a year, or even longer, as this fight has been happening not only between administrations, but also in federal court?
So it's interesting because the name Deferred Action in and of itself just implies that they are deferring negative action mm-hmm. against the people in this program, which means they're not actively deporting them. But that's not the same as being a resident or a citizen where you have a lawful status in the country that is protected. So I call it a pseudo status, that pseudo status. They're not going to deport you, but you're not actually lawfully present for purposes of immigration laws.
Yeah, there's no box on the form for
correct.
This, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in a very literal sense, when folks look at it. So what's the advice? What are you hearing from your clients and from others that may qualify, may be eligible, were eligible, and are looking at this action and trying to figure out what best process to take?
You know, some people are very positive that at least this is being talked about, it's being considered, it's being discussed, but it's also really frustration is what I'm hearing the most. Frustration that there isn't a permanent path being put into place. Frustration that the dates aren't being extended for more people to qualify. You know, just the economic benefits alone to our local and economies, to federal tax benefits. It's just nuts to not think that these people are a benefit for the country overall. So frustration is the main thing I'm hearing.
Tim, immigration has been front and center for the Biden administration, certainly as it relates to South Florida immigration stories because of what's happened not only in Haiti, but also what's been happening on the U.S.-Texas border with Haitian migrants. Where does and how does DACA fall into the list of priorities for the Biden administration and immigration?
That's what's so strange about all of this is that last year, for example, when the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration trying to get rid of DACA, polls showed that a very strong majority of Americans were for some sort of permanent DACA legislation that would give these people a path to citizenship. And we all thought at that time that this was going to be a real impetus, a real driver for finally immigration reform in Congress. It just never happened. And so they're hoping now, the Biden administration is hoping, that this new wrinkle will now push more incentive to pass what's called the American Dream and Promise Act in Congress. But again, I mean, we can't even get, you know, Congress right now to pass, you know,
the debt ceiling increase.
So, I mean, I think we're going to be just as disappointed this year as we were last year.
Alina, talk to that issue that Tim is referring to, specifically in terms of the process here, because this is all based on executive branch decisions and actions. It came out of President Obama, the White House. President Trump took action. Yes, there has been judicial action and judgment passed on this, but Congress has been on the sidelines. There has not been a legislative appetite or a legislative, really a legislative movement.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, executive orders aren't supposed to be substitutes for traditional policymaking on big issues. It really is time for Congress to step in and do something, make something happen. And when Obama did step in, he did it, I am sure, out of the same frustration that we weren't seeing anything move forward. It was an inspired move as far as I'm concerned, but I do understand why it's coming up with so much litigation, because this is not the way it's supposed to work. We should have some permanent protection for these people.
And the current status or the current situation in the southern border and what we saw last week and in previous weeks, particularly with Haitian migrants, how do you think that, Alina, is influencing the advocacy community?
You know, it's the images that came out of the border recently are quite disturbing, for lack of a better word. You know, unfortunately, there is a historical basis for us shunning Haitian migrants and really Black migration overall. I think that's a whole other racial topic that to be covered there. And, you know, it's they've been invoking Title 42. The COVID pandemic has really created an opportunity to make specifically the asylum process even more prohibitive over the last year and a half. The Trump administration really took off with that. And unfortunately, Biden hasn't done enough to come back from that, in my opinion.
Tim, we have seen some South Florida legislative voices rise up, in particular regarding immigration and the Haitian migrant situation on the Texas border. Do you anticipate hearing more about DACA as the Biden administration tries to push this forward?
Well, that is one thing that is unique about South Florida. As we see in the congressional delegation here, both sides of the aisle do tend to speak up for immigrants and Haitian immigrants as well. I think Republicans have also here realized how important that is to this community. And so, you know, again, we're hoping that Republican and Democratic voices from this region, given how immigrant rich this region is, will help push forward legislation like the American Dream and Promise Act. But again, if it didn't happen last year, I just don't see how this sort of Band-Aid, you know, frankly, procedural gesture that the Biden administration is making for DACA right now is going to create, you know, is going to galvanize Congress to do anything this year.
Something's happening in November of 22 that Congress may be focused on, that election, that midterm election may step in way.
Well, again, and between, you know, based on what we're seeing now on Capitol Hill between now and November 22, I think unfortunately we are going to see, you know, both parties just sort of playing to their bases instead of trying to convince each other.
Yeah. Tim Padgett, the America's editor here at WLRN. Tim, always a pleasure. Thanks for sharing your report.
Thank you.
Alina, great to have you on as well. Alina Santana, immigration attorney with Santana Rodriguez Law in Miami. Thanks for sharing your perspective too.
Thank you.
Well, another wonderful pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup, and it really is made possible with support from you at times like this. Continue to make your contribution at 866-247-9576. You can call or text the word GIVE to that phone number, 866-247-9576 or WLRN.org.
Hello, listeners. This is Anna in the Crossings. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup today. The show is produced by Andrea Perdomo. WLRN's engagement editor is Katie LaPree-Cohen. Lance Dixon is WLRN's digital editor. WLRN's news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is WLRN's editorial director. The director of radio operations and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers phones. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866 347-9576. Thanks for listening and calling in.
Thank you for helping us out here on this special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. Wonderful to have everybody along. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.